thank you so much. And Tom, you know, we really appreciate the opportunity to get in front of all of you. I'll give you a little background on my agency. So United Agencies was formed back in 1962 by my grandfather and about five other gentlemen. And today we probably have about 30 locations throughout Southern California. We're one of the premier insurance agencies in Southern California. Our clients, you know, range from San Diego up to the Bay Area normally. We do things a little bit differently here than most insurance agencies where they're just giving you a policy. We invest a good portion of our commission back into additional services to help your business be successful. One of them is Mondo, who does all of our safety consulting for all of our clients and does a great job. We're finding him to be very beneficial these days because of COVID and a lot of other areas where employment practices liability come into play. You know, we partner with a few key people. Armando is one of them. Another one is American Consulting, who does all of our human resources consulting. And that's all free to all of our clients. And then, you know, workers' comp has been a real thorn, I'm sure, in everybody's sides these days, because I'll tell you, 95% of the claims that I'm seeing across my clients are fraudulent. So we don't rely just on an adjuster to do their job. They got too big of a caseload these days. So we hire a partner called Risk Solutions, who monitors all of your work comp claims, kind of takes that aspect away from you so you can concentrate on selling cars. And they've been great at reducing ex-mods, reducing reserves, putting surveillance on clients. So yeah, I mean, we're here to help in any way that we can. If you guys ever need a second look at your insurance, and we're just happy to be in front of you.
Okay.
I'll let you take over, Mondo.
Thank you, Jeff. Woo. The purpose, the main goal of this presentation, everyone, is to try to when I put it together, I wanted to establish some steps that we can all take in order to stabilize our business. Jeff mentioned some of the services that United offers, and the purpose of these additional services was to assist the customers with their business stabilization. Well, when I started working in safety, that's my specialty, I was in the trucking industry, and I started working on the freight docks. I had, I developed an affinity for the movement of the goods, because I just kind of saw the step-by-step or realized the step-by-step procedure, how it kind of materialized in the end, making it to its final destination. And I could picture the people opening their box or receiving their pallet and everything being intact and in good condition, and then what would occur thereafter. However, as part of that process, or enjoying it, I started to study the DOT, the Department of Transportation, and also the OSHA regulations, and put a focus, I put some focus on hazardous materials. Well, with all that studying and schooling I had to go through, the attacks in New York kind of put a screwball in my career path. And for the first time, I started working in transportation in 86, 87. And for the first time, I experienced a layoff. So I really had to make some changes in my personal career path. And I had no clue that safety would be a smooth transition. My brother was doing safety, and we had talked, and he talked to me a little bit about what he was doing and the trainings and the inspections and some of the similarities to the trucking, logistics, and warehousing business. So I thought, let's give it a shot. And over a period of time, I was able to develop a small book of business. I went back to school and received my professional certification as an occupational safety and health professional. And I opened up, or I founded the facility management group, FMG Consultations, in 2006. There's five areas of concern or five areas of pandemic regulation, I should say, that I really want to focus on today. The purpose of, again, the purpose of this presentation is to try to provide you some insight in, as to how to use regulations that seem to be imposing on California employers, how we can use them in order to protect our assets. But if you don't understand the code and the process in order to achieve that protection, then asset protection, it can be frustrating, and there could be some losses in the end. What I just want to do is focus on five areas, and the goal is definitely to elevate your knowledge of the OSHA safety code as it pertains to the COVID regulations. So there is these five items here, or five areas of concern, will be the foundation of our discussion. Each of these items needs to be a part of your infection control plan at work. However, what I'm finding over the last 2 years, I've handled several different OSHA cases, several where none of these five items is in place, and it created a definite instability for the client. There is a value in the infection control plan. Not only does it keep your people healthy, but also it does protect your liabilities. And I'll explain that further. Investigation of COVID positive cases. There's instances, Jeff mentioned some of, well, a good portion or percentage of claims are fraudulent. There is some instances where some of the positive COVID cases, not so much that they're fraudulent, but the reporting is erroneous. The employee, in some cases, has the power to say where he contracted or she contracted the illness. And in many, many instances, it's the doctor's office that is asking them, where do you think you got this from? And if they're going to the doctor right after a work shift, or they interrupted their work shift because they weren't feeling well, it's most likely they will probably say, I think I got it at work. The word think being the key term. I think I got it at work. Well, the doctor from that point on basically notes it onto the report. And until otherwise proven, it's considered work-related, when in fact there was some other contingencies involved that I'll explain in a moment how we can help uncover those and protect the company from having to pay certain penalties and fines. When an employee has been hospitalized, there is an OSHA requirement for notification. Again, under that rule, I believe it's the Title 8 342 section, there's a timeline for notification to OSHA when an employee has been hospitalized. But here again, I've experienced where the employee didn't report the incident or the illness at all to the employer. For the most part, it's because it's something they acquired outside of work, like a family member who's ill. And then they admit themselves to the hospital after a work shift or an interrupted shift. And automatically, the hospitals and medical centers notify OSHA. It's part of the system's check and balances. When an employee admits themselves or goes to a hospital or an industrial clinic, automatically the hospitals notify OSHA that it's work-related, and then it's up to the employer to prove otherwise. It's rare, number four, but I have seen it occur where there's a failure to provide personal protective equipment. We'll take a look at that. And then lastly, I have seen in the majority of the cases I handled where there was a failure to train not only the employees, but also the supervisors on the program or plan that the employer did acquire. In some cases, they have one, which is good, but it doesn't do much if you fail to perform the training. On each slide, well, not each one, but on some of the introductory slides into each stability element, like this one, infection control, you'll see the OSHA code at the top. I highlighted about five or six codes, so I would encourage you to make a note of them, because you can Google it, Title 8, comma, section 3203, parentheses A, and it'll give you a synopsis of the requirements for infection control. I also noted them because these are the actual codes OSHA's using when there is a notice of citation and penalty. It gets expensive. And we'll talk about now with regard to infection control, how to protect ourselves. On the 3203A, for lack of better words, there is a failure of employers to enforce some of the regulation underneath this section 3203A. For example, the physical distancing, the masking requirements, which is now all gone in California, I believe. However, there's been some recent events in China in particular, where there seems to be a rumor masking might come back. So whether masking's here or not, there are still some other rules under the 3203 that employers are required to enforce, like the disinfecting. I'm finding in the cases that I handled, the employers were following the rules, but there was a failure to document what they were doing. And if it's not documented, and you do unfortunately have to handle an OSHA case, it could be considered that it was not done. The fact that you did perform it, however, you have no documentation of it, and you lack a program, it could be deemed that the enforcement of the 3203 regulation was not in place. The penalties start for the 3203A violation at $1,200. Basically, the penalty is for failure to have a program. And in that program, it articulates the measures you're going to take to keep everybody healthy. So the penalties start at $1,200, and the cost of a program ranges between $500 and $700. So you can see the imbalance. Why people or employers are not acquiring a program is a really, really big question. Lynn, I wanted to ask you if you could elect somebody, choose somebody from the gallery, and let's just throw it out there. Let's just one person, let's see their point of view. Why do we think there is instances where employers don't have a program?
Lynn maybe stepped away for a sec. Armando, I just keep moving along.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Did you ask me a question? I'm sorry.
No worries. Yes, please. I would like you to elect somebody from the gallery, just one person, to get a point of view. Why would an employer not have an infection control plan, considering we're just about 2.5 years into this virus? And unfortunately, there is quite a few cases where the employer doesn't have a plan. And then there's cases where they have one, but they're not activating some of the measures that their own plan requires. Could you pick somebody and we'll simply ask them, why would an employer not have a plan at this stage of the game?
Okay. Do I have any volunteers? Would you like to talk about what you have, what you don't have? If you're doing anything, pretty much everybody's on mute and I'm only seeing, unfortunately, Nelly and Patty. So I don't know if either one of you gals want to, you're both on mute. So if you are willing to talk, if you would shake your head, I will unmute you.
What was the question? I didn't hear it.
I was just going to say, he wants to know if you have a plan and if you're using it, and if you're using it, how, and if you're not using it, why not?
Let me expound on that just a little bit. I just want to make a couple changes. It's very well known that many employers at this stage of the virus, they don't have plans at all. Why do you think an employer would not have a plan? We're about 2.5 years into the virus, why would they not have an infection control plan? What do you think?
Maybe they don't know how to do it. Maybe they don't know where to get one. I use KPA for my COVID plan and my IIPP also. We have it in KPA.
That's an excellent answer. And it's one of the reasons why I'm teaming with United Agencies, because United Agencies is making attempts to inform not only their customers, but also anybody out there who has a bent ear, that there is an answer. The failure to have the program, that would be a citation under the 3203 code, and it runs at about $5,000, where I already mentioned the program cost is between $500 and $700. Then you've got the case where employers do have a plan. They connected with somebody, they got an affordable program, it's on the shelf, but they failed to activate some of the specific measures that are in it in order to control, in order to keep people healthy. And there again, there could be a penalty, and it's $1,200. Having the program and not activating it versus not having one at all is two different things, but there's definitely a disconnect with regard to the value of the program. For under $1,000, you put something in place, if you don't already have one, that definitely will keep your crew healthy. And in the event there is an illness, you have tangible evidence to show we're doing everything we can to keep our employees infection free. In the next in this next segment, I call it stability elements, the investigation. Here's where you're made aware that there is a positive COVID case. If you're not aware that somebody's positive, then there's no need to investigate. However, in the event that an employee calls you or they come to your office and tell you that they're positive, that would trigger the need to conduct an investigation. I have a question, Aline. Could you pick somebody?
Nelly.
Nelly, here's the question.
Okay.
How can an employer prove, or at least establish reasonable doubt, that a COVID case is not work related?
That's a tough one. We cannot. I don't think we can.
Well, one thing's for sure.
Unless that employee would go to another employee and said they went somewhere on the weekend or something to that effect, and they were at a party, or then
there are some contingencies. There are definitely some contingencies. What I'm finding is many employers are not conducting the investigation. Inside of the investigation, inside of your program, infection control program, there's elements that you would follow in order to conduct a thorough investigation. Similar to a vehicle accident, many, many carriers will issue, along with your declaration of insurance, a little packet, maybe a tri or bifold flyer, and you open it, and it has 5 or 6 or 7 little checklist items in the event of an accident, some things that you can follow in order to secure some basic information. Well, if you're not conducting an investigation and you've been made aware, that's the key, you've been made aware that there's a positive case, that could lead to a brick wall. OSHA requires all the employers to activate their infection control plan and conduct investigation of work-related illness and injury. But many employers are failing to trigger their programs and perform the investigation. One of the reasons is when they acquired their program, they neglected to assign someone to perform that duty. There's a sense of overconfidence, I guess you can say. I've got a program, I'm in compliance, let me continue on with my business. And we neglect the fact that we're still not out of the woods. COVID's still out there, and hopefully it doesn't grow to the extent it was a few months ago or a year ago. I'd like to think that it will keep going down. However, it's still there, And it benefits the employer who has a program or who's listening today, acquire one and consider these elements of stability. Automatically go to the investigation section and ask yourself, how can I prove the case, the COVID case is not work related if I have no documents to support that claim? I might know that the worker, because of what Nelly just said, there is conversations that they have somebody at home who's ill, and I'm aware of that because they might have told me, but I failed to perform the investigation and fill out the report. So I don't have any documentation to bring to the hearing. It's called an informal conference with OSHA when this subject comes up. So I like everybody to consider, who could you designate for the task? And is that person competent to train other people in order to help them? The penalties for failure to investigate start at $5,000. So we've got $1,200 for failure to activate the program, if you have one. You've got $5,000 for failure to conduct the investigation. I have a question here. Do you know how to create an events and causal factor analysis chart? In one of the hearings, informal conferences I participated in, it was a question that was asked of an employer that I wasn't representing. It was multiple employers being called into one issue. It's the multi-employer law, Assembly Bill 1127. You can have more than one employer responsible for one incident. While the employer that I wasn't representing, they were asked that question, and they had some difficulty answering it. So that leads me into the notification of hospitalization. When is notification of a hospitalization that's work-related required? Lynn, would you pick someone?
Okay. How about Terry?
Hi, Terry.
Terry? Oh, not there. All right. How about Michelle?
Hi, Michelle.
I don't see anybody. All I see is like their names, but I can't tell if she's on mute.
Understood. Okay. I just want to try to engage the gallery. No worries at all.
Yeah.
Okay. So everyone.
I could answer what my understanding is. Sure. That you have to notify OSHA if, number one, they go away in an ambulance. Oh, I do not, Terry, I do not have a mic. Oh, okay. Terry can't, she doesn't have a mic. So that was your question, right? When do you have to notify OSHA of an illness?
There is some criteria when OSHA needs to be notified of a hospitalization. Just to clarify, there is instances where an employee being ambulanced to a medical facility, most definitely there is some instances where automatically, if I was the HR person for that company, I'm jumping on the telephone and letting OSHA know, because there was some criteria that was met. With respect to the COVID, the notification is required within 8 hours of hospitalization. But there is some dynamics here. And I got a red bullet point here, the third one. There are instances where an employee, while on duty, reports their illness to the supervisor. But due to the severity of their illness, the employee, they ask to leave work. And then as they're driving home or somebody picked them up, as they're in the car being transported, hopefully to home, it reaches a point where they realize, you know, I'm just feeling really bad. I don't feel good at all. I want to go to the hospital. So they admit themselves. Now, the dynamic here is the employee was infected by someone at home, not at work. And in the work area, there is barriers being set up in order to protect workers that must work within 6 feet of one another, kind of like an assembly line. For example, there'll be a plastic barrier put in between each worker that would qualify as a viable barrier. we're talking about an employer who has issued proper protection, respiratory protection. Everything's in place. Their program is activated. This employee doesn't feel well. They excuse themselves on the way home. They detour. They go to the hospital. There's someone infected at home. But because they're hospitalized directly from the work, the hospital reports it as work-related. How do you protect your company from OSHA in a case like this? Any takers on that question?
I would say we're going to go back to the documentation. I mean, if the employee is admitting to being at a family party or whatever, and now they've all got COVID, and now I'm not feeling well, I'm gonna tell you that we've had more than one person come down with COVID that is not work related, and they've said, I was at my grandma's house over the weekend and I woke up not feeling well, so I'm not coming in. And then they say, everybody at the party now has COVID. So we're told that. So I would think that would be, if you were told and obviously documenting it, which I'm going to say, I'm going to be honest with you, I'm not documenting if, you know, you called out and said, hey, I was at a party and I'm not feeling well, and then you come back in the next day or you call me the next day and say, I'm not coming in, I've tested positive. I don't mark down that, you know, you called on Monday, called out and said that, you know, you were at a party and you think you might have COVID. I am not documenting that. But if I had, I think that would be my way of proving to whoever OSHA that it was not a work-related incident.
I tell you, Alin, the note-taking can definitely be tedious. And I'm with you, your point of view on documenting certain conversations. With respect to the notification of the hospitalization and protecting the employer from the $5,000 penalty under Title 8 342A, it's $5,000. What I would suggest to do is perform a training with all employees, notifying them of their responsibility to report work-related injury and illness, and you conduct an orientation. It could be a whole department all at once. It could be conducted in cell format, you know, five people here, five people there. It totally depends on the operation and how they want to arrange to disseminate the information. But one thing is for sure, in one of the cases that I handled, the OSHA inspector asked, have you trained your employees on their responsibility to report work-related injury or illness? And the employer, unfortunately, had not conducted, even at the beginning of the work contract, when you're handing out certain pamphlets and employee handbooks, there was never any discussion of how to report work-related injury and illness. And the ticket for that violation, Title 8 342A, $5,000. Really, really easy to avoid. So simple. Right. It's kind of paradoxical. You don't believe it. But most definitely, it's something that I like everybody to consider, because you have it on file. We're still early in the year. If you haven't conducted orientations, it's really simple. Not only would you mention the employee's responsibility to report work-related accidents and illnesses, but also there's some other things you might bring up in order to create a nice 15, say 20 minute meeting that's really productive, talking about personal protective equipment, talking about the signs and symptoms of illness that would trigger or justify notifying your supervisor. Also too, the investigation process, so that the employees are not leery or nervous or scared. Basically, everything's transparent and letting them know the purpose of our program is truly to keep you healthy. Okay, PPE. For the most part, not an issue. I've handled, I mentioned several cases, not an issue, but there was a couple where there was a citation for it. The code section is Title 8, Section 3380, through 3203A7, there's a code basically for every part of the body and some type of protection that's required based on the hazards, of course. You don't have to suit up like the person in the picture every single day. It all depends on the hazards. So let's go into the next slide. Just for clarity, unless you have a contract, unless you are hiring independent contractors, employers are required to provide the personal protective equipment. Okay, it's under section 3380. That question does come up to me by managers over the years. It's come up quite a few times. I'm surprised in some cases, but you know, if you don't understand the regulations, well, there should be no surprise. So I just let them know it's under Title 8, Section 3380. If the person is potentially exposed to flying objects, then they should have some safety glasses. And if there's contaminations in the air, they do sewer work, then they should have some respiratory protection. Number two, all new hires must receive training on the required PPE. That could be incorporated into your orientation. Training must be provided when there's a change of job duties or job assignment. Whenever new substances, processes, procedures, or equipment are introduced to the workplace and represent a new hazard. For number four, the airborne contaminant, airborne virus would definitely qualify for the necessity to perform training. And I want to add on that, your training time doesn't have to be an hour or a half an hour. You can decide how to present the material in an effective manner and potentially 5 to 10 minutes. It just depends on the information you want to get across and if there's any handout that goes with it. Handouts are good too. Maybe even a short true and false test. 5 questions, 10 questions. Number five, training for supervisors to familiarize them with safety and health hazards that might affect their employees and the PPE to control the hazards. Number five is where I have seen there is a disconnect. Employers that have the programs, unfortunately, they never activated the portion that reads or the element that states supervisors need to understand how to activate the program as well. There's different responsibilities a supervisor or a lead might play. There should be somebody responsible for analyzing the work areas to make sure that they're healthy, that they're safe. There should be somebody responsible for the procurement of supplies, the disinfecting materials, or the personal protective equipment. There should be somebody assigned to the incident investigation in the event the employer is made aware. It could sound to be heavy on the shoulders, a lot of work, but the truth is, it's really not. If you've acquired a program through a resource that provides value, kind of what Jeff mentioned in the beginning of our show, some of the values that United Agencies offers, along with the program will come the training. And in many cases, there's no additional costs for it. It's a whole part of the process because another one of our purposes here today is to add value to your business. We're hoping that no one in your business gets sick, and we do understand the realities, and we'd like to give you something, a tool to protect yourself. So should anybody need a program and you contacted Jeff or myself for assistance in that area, you would also receive an offer to provide the training. It would come right along with it and get your supervisors involved so they know what to do. Lastly, with regard to personal protective equipment, are the barriers set up? There was, in the month of November, October, an informal conference I handled for a food manufacturer in the city of Vernon, California. Well, there was illness. When you've got 3 illnesses within a 2-week period, it's considered an outbreak. So a 14-day period. There was an outbreak, unfortunately, and that triggered an OSHA inspection. When they got to that food manufacturing facility, there was one portion of the conveyor system where the workers are packing, and they have to stand within 6 feet of one another. And we're talking November, October last year. And unfortunately, in those areas, there was no plastic barriers. The employer felt their defense was, we have the face shields, we have the face coverings, the mask, and even safety glasses underneath. and OSHA did not accept it. Under the 3380 in conjunction with 3203A7, it was reasonable for the employer to take one additional step and set up barrier. Here's where the insight of having a professional, someone who specializes in safety, helps to protect your asset. This food manufacturer was depending solely on their in-house safety representative who specialized in food safety. There is a difference between food safety and a virus causing a health pandemic to people. It would have been prudent for them to step outside of the box and get someone's advice. I mention this because that evaluation that they could have requested, depending on their relation to the safety people that they ask, that they're working with, it could be $200-$300, $400. The penalty that they suffered on the Title VIII sections noted on the screen was another $5,000. It could have easily been avoided. And number six is where there was a failure, according to OSHA. The training requirements. OSHA requires training for employees to include information on COVID infection and how the virus spreads, the signs and the symptoms, proper hygiene, safe work practices, incident reporting, and the plan to control and prevent transmission. In a nutshell, an employer who spends, say you've got 10, 15, 20 workers in a room or standing in their work area, and you take 10, 15 minutes to discuss these matters, you got some handouts, maybe kind of like the one handout fits everything all plugged into one. In 10 to 15 minutes with 10 to 15 people, you could essentially provide decent training, decent information for the crew. It wouldn't hurt to expand on it in the coming days after, maybe take one item out of the equation here and highlight it in a separate meeting, again, maybe 5 to 10 minutes. But just with respect to showing proof of training requirements and having the documentation, it's not complicated. Unfortunately, it's not being done. And here again, your penalty is another $1,200 to $1,500. For one of the employers that I worked with, they did do the training. It was conducted. They had made this known to me. However, when I asked them as part of the investigation process to prepare their defense, do you have any documents of that training? There was no roster. There was no minutes of the discussion. So unfortunately, OSHA applied the safety code for that matter, and it was about $1,500. Lynn, I've got a couple slides left, about four of them pertaining to the supplemental paid sick leave. And before I review it, I want to ask if there's any questions out there, maybe the chat room.
I don't have any questions in the chat as of yet. I, however, have a question. Yes. So you talk about the plastic barriers. We have these plastic sheets that separate the cashiers, and then we have one in between each counterman. And that really looks like crap. I mean, it just really looks okey. I want to take them down, but now what you're saying here, I don't know that we should, because they're definitely not 6 feet apart.
Okay, that last phrase, definitely not 6 feet apart.
Right.
Up to this point, to my knowledge, and I'm keeping up on this pretty regularly, up to this point, to my knowledge, rules on physical distancing have not really been addressed. I am clear on masking. I believe it started in February, on February the 19th, or somewhere in mid-February, where indoor and outdoor masking required mandates have been relaxed. However, the physical distancing rules, I really haven't heard any discussions on that. So if you were to email me or call me, or I showed up to the dealership to conduct a meeting, and you call me over, hey Mondo, what do you think about this area? Is it okay to bring down the physical barrier, the plexiglass? I would probably suggest to you let's leave it up a little bit longer.
Alan,
your staff might be able, if they feel comfortable, to be maskless. There is no rules on that at this time. However, maybe the barrier to stay up a little bit longer. Somebody has something to say.
Yeah. This is Jeff. Alan, we have 40 people in our office, and we have the plexiglass up at every workstation, and we definitely want to take it down now that things have, you know, calmed down a little bit. We're not going to right now, just in case things come back in again, if there's, you know, another wave. But I think for some employees, it's a sense of protection that they now feel.
Okay.
So for us, you know, we're in a real pickle because a majority of us want us to take it down, and some of the employees do. But then there are a few that really, you know, are still wearing their mask at their workstation. They do appreciate the plexiglass. So it's kind of a moving target right now, I think, for all of us until, you know, a little bit more time passes. So I would recommend you keep it up for right now.
Well, it's literally not plexiglass. It's literally up at the Target. You bought the clear plastic shower curtains
right
from the ceiling. I mean, that's what's up there.
Right.
And it just looks awful. But, you know, and then our salespeople have the little plexiglass in between them and the customer that we have told them, you can take it off. But when a customer comes, if they want it up, put it back up. So
sure.
We were thinking we could buy some of those portable glasses for the customers and the employees. But then I said to Tom, well, what about the employees and the employees? Because they are not, you know, we've got them crammed in. There's three guys on an 8-foot counter. So yeah, they're definitely not 6 feet apart.
Right. And this even dives into another whole, you know, discussion. So ever since COVID hit, we've seen an increase in employment practices, liability claims, and directors and officers, right? Most of them are baseless, but they're coming based off an unsafe work environment. And so that's why it's so important to have an infectious control plan in place and that you're documenting everything. So we're seeing a rise in that, in those claims. We're seeing increased rates on all of our renewals on EPLI and DNO because of this over the last 2 years. It's really important that all of you keep up an updated injury and illness prevention plan, your IIPP, because every year the laws change, right? And they're requiring us to do more and more as an employers. Your employee handbook is so important. That's the rules of engagement of employment for each one of your companies. And at the end of the day, I mean, listen, our HR manager here goes nuts, but she documents everything because when it comes down to it, you need to have as much documentation as you can. I tell all of my clients, do not fire any employee until you've spoken to our human resources consulting firm. Because a lot of the time, you know, you don't have enough documentation to actually fire that person. Even though we're in an at-will state, you can fire anybody you want. But I can guarantee you, you're probably going to have a wrongful termination claim, and you're most likely going to get a CT, a cumulative trauma work comp claim that is, you know, total fraud. So those are things I was kind of saving for the end. But like, you know, those are things to think about. Make sure you're doing all those things correctly. If you need any help with them, we're more than happy to, you know, to help out. One good thing that the WCIRB, who governs workers' comp for California, COVID claims do not count against your XMOD, right? Your experience mod. So it's very important that, you know, when you're working with your broker, just to double check that, to make sure no claims that were COVID related are on that, because carriers make mistakes. Right. We do a thorough job of examining every experience mod with our clients, matching up the claims to make sure it's correct. Because at the end of the day, if we can take off some of those claims, we're going to save you money and premium. So those are kind of a few highlights that I just wanted to go over since this topic came up.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jeff.
You got it.
With regard to benefits under the COVID plan, this is good for employers to know. Our governor ratified a bill an emergency, I shouldn't say emergency, but he did ratify a plan beginning January 1st through September 30th, basically a 9-month period of this year, the first 9 months of this year. Employers with 26 or more employees are required to provide up to 80 hours of COVID-19 related sick leave. There are some requirements though of the employee. So let's take a look at that. A full-time covered employee may take up to 40 hours of leave if the employee is unable to work or telework for any of the following reasons. There's more than vaccine related. There's a couple more, so we'll illustrate that now. Vaccine related, the covered employee is attending a vaccine or booster appointment for themselves or a family member, or cannot work or telework because they have vaccine related symptoms or are caring for a family member with vaccine related symptoms. I have a note at the bottom. An employer may limit an employee to 24 hours or 3 days of leave for each vaccination or booster appointment and any consequent side effects unless a healthcare provider verifies that more recovery time is needed. That's important information. So the employer does have some power here. You can limit the amount of time pertaining to vaccination or boosters, 24 hours or 3 days of leave. The rights to the benefits also can occur if you're caring for yourself. An employee is subject to quarantine or isolation period related to COVID-19. An employee is also covered if they have been advised by a healthcare provider to quarantine or if they are experiencing COVID-19 symptoms and seeking a medical diagnosis. The subtext here is that employee providing the employer proof that they are positive. This right to the benefit isn't indefinite, just based solely on my report to Jeff that I'm ill, and Jeff being my employer, my supervisor. I do need to, my responsibility under this rule, I do need to provide proof that I am COVID positive. If you're caring for a family member, an employee is caring for a family member who is subject to COVID-19 quarantine or isolation period, or has been advised by a healthcare provider to quarantine due to COVID-19, or is caring for a child whose school or place of care is closed due to COVID-19 on the premises. And I made a note. A family member includes child, parent, spouse, registered domestic partner, grandparent, grandchild, or sibling. Full-time covered employee may take up to an additional 40 hours of leave if the employee is unable to work or telework for either of the following reasons. The covered employee tests positive for COVID-19. The covered employee is caring for a family member who tested positive for COVID-19. Part-time covered employees may take as leave up to the amount of hours they work over 2 weeks, with half of those hours available only when they or the family member test positive for COVID-19. Lynn, does that sound clear to you? Should I repeat it again?
No, that I understand that.
Okay. Yeah. If an employee takes leave for any of the covered reasons between January 2022, January 1st, and February 19th, and that leave was either unpaid or compensated at a rate less than the employee's regular rate of pay, the employee may also request a retroactive payment. Payment is at the employee's regular or usual rate of pay, not to exceed $511 a day and $5,110 in total. This is an important focal point or highlight point. Unfortunately, there are some employers that don't understand the rules, and they're just really, really bogged down to the extent that they're maybe lost some compassion. So with that said, I want to add this statement. Employees who feel discrimination or retaliation for requesting benefits under this rule may file a claim with the Labor Commissioner's office. I just want everybody to be aware. In the event that somebody does report it, there is some rules to benefit those employees. And at the same time, they also have responsibility to show proof of positive testing. In summary, during 2021, I consulted with multiple companies on infection control strategies, and I represented a client in an OSHA hearing where over $24,000 of penalties were being imposed due to alleged COVID infection at work. Based on my direct case experience, I urge all ADOMA members to protect your financial stability from COVID penalties by acquiring an infection control plan, if you don't have one, train and assign a supervisor to investigate COVID positive cases, notify OSHA in the event of hospitalization, if you're aware, and inform them when the case is not work-related. Provide the required PPE and train your staff. The government seems, there does seem to be an imposition, I guess, for lack of better terms, a financial burden being imposed on employers in order to help with this COVID-19. It's the hope of the United Agency Insurance Group that all of the ADOMA members use this presentation to fortify your business and protect it against unnecessary penalty. We hope that through our focus on the OSHA codes, you'll take active steps to implement simple processes and strengthen your company and maintain good health of your employees. With that, I'd like to thank you all for this opportunity. Thank you, Alin. Jeff, if you would take over.
Yeah, we really appreciate the opportunity to get in front of you guys. If there's anything that we can help you with, we're more than happy. We're hands-on. We're both local to the area. And I think that's what we have done today to help you.
Does anybody have any questions? Nobody in the chat? Anybody want to ask any questions that we didn't cover? For us here at our dealership, I mean, once he announced that you could get pay, we had a bunch of people say, okay, I want my money. I want my money. Mm-hmm. And I said, fine, we'll give you your money. Here's a form. But you want more than your 40 hours. You got to give me a proof. And he said, well, he saw me take a test. And I'm like, you have to go to a medical doctor. You can't do the fast test. You can't do the home test. You literally have to go to a medical doctor. And then they're like, okay, just give me my 40 hours.
Okay.
And it ended up where some people, their pay retroing back to 90 days was more than $511. So we got that. That was a good thing that he did, that he capped it, because we had some guys that were going to be, you know, outrageous money. So.
And it's hard to keep up with all this because it's constantly changing. We'll probably see another change in the next 6 months. So hopefully not, but it's a moving target right now, and it's making it very difficult for employers to stay on top of it. It really is.
So I've been dealing with COVID for 2 years now, and it's like a full-time job. So right. I have a book that has, you know, whether they've been vaccinated or not. I have a roster of who's vaccinated, who's not. I was able to have some of my managers be able to be on the COVID team because we can't police everyone of who's vaccinated, who's not by wearing masks. So we have a team of like 13 people at different departments. And then as far as the COVID pay, I mean, each one is a thorough investigation. We have them fill out a form of who they've been around for the last 48 hours and within less than 6 feet. And we try to get the story of where they got the COVID. Most of them, I mean, 90% of them did not get it at work. They got it at home. So we have all that. It's just been a real full-time job just handling COVID. And then as far as this COVID pay, yeah, we have a lot of people that maxed out at the 511 a day. We have people doing the retro, but I'm not paying people that didn't request it in writing on the retro. So I do still have about 10, 15 people that haven't requested it. And so, I mean, I'm not going to, you know, hunt them down and beg them to take the COVID pay when they had it in January and February. So currently we're going forward with it all. It's just been my whole life for 2 years, pretty much. So the problem I have is in the beginning, I called the health department when we had three or more cases within a 2 week period. They never called me back. I called them like 5 times. So I don't even bother calling them anymore. I mean, we don't have any right now, but we have gone through waves where there's several people in several stores and several departments that are out with COVID. So I don't know what how big of a risk that is by not calling it into the health department. I missed a lot of this meeting because I'm doing payroll today. So I've been bopping in and out of my office doing payroll. But so I'm sure you went over that area of it. How much of a penalty is it if you don't call in three or more cases, Armando?
The rule to contact the local city or the county, OSHA doesn't enforce that. If there was okay. to be a penalty, it would be imposed by that city or county.
Oh,
however,
okay.
however, OSHA does want to know when you have a case. If there's three or more within that 14-day period, they do want to know. So it does benefit you to contact OSHA. And, you know, quite frankly, since you're already in the practice of basically being responsible, that's what I'm hearing from you. You're trying to be responsible. But right. unfortunately, because of the government's just probably being overwhelmed by the rules that they are making for themselves and for everybody to follow, they failed to follow up with you. That should have been part of the process. It's not uncommon, though. I wouldn't allow that to deter you from your sense of responsibility, because in the event that you are issued a notice of citation and penalty from OSHA, that documentation that you're even notifying outside agencies, it will firm up your case to show truly your responsibility and your understanding of the reporting process. And you probably got the documents to support those reports that you called in. So it puts
no,
you in
I
a
don't.
Good
I mean, I made phone calls. Nobody answered. I would leave messages, but you know, there's no documentation that I called them and tried to leave a report. You know, it was a phone
I
call.
See. When OSHA's contacted, they have when you contact OSHA, the district office for accident or illness, there is some instances where a person doesn't answer. It's a voicemail. However, it's logged. It is logged. So you're making the note to yourself, the time and the date that you called, and that machine does the same, kind of like calling 911. It's logged. The okay. same thing applies for these government agencies. The fact of the matter is, whether or not they're checking on it, I don't think it's really here or there. I just appreciate the fact that you're following procedure. And in the event, hopefully it never occurs, but in the event that you were to receive a notice of citation and penalty, you got a nice file that shows your level of responsibility and the fact that you're trying to take the steps that the state, the city, the county are imposing. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, in that hearing, hopefully you never have to go through it, you could ask the question, why was I never given a follow-up phone call, an email, a letter? And all of a sudden, the room goes quiet, and you've got a nice defense showing you're taking every action to keep people healthy, keep your business running, and follow this overwhelming imposition of rules.
And why are they making the employers pay this COVID pay now? Why isn't it part of, you know, the tax credit anymore?
I can answer the part of why they're requiring the employers to cover it. The part on tax credit, that's difficult for me to answer. I'm going to go to Jeff to see if he might have somebody in mind, because we could always get back to everybody. We'll get an answer on that. We'll make note now if we can't get an answer now. But the first part is, why is it being required for the employer? Well, you know, it's political reasons. And not to mention, the employer is the first line of defense. Basically, the first line of defense. If a citizen of the state is to receive any benefit, who would most likely be able to issue that benefit most quickly? The state or the employer? The employer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
yeah, they're pushing it. They're pushing it back to us. No, they're just pushing it back to us as employers. Yeah, we felt the same way. Why are we paying for this? And, you know, backdating so far. Mm-hmm. It's not fair. It's not right. You know,
right.
I haven't been able to find out exactly in any written laws that have been printed on this of why it comes back to us. But we can look into those questions for you, Colleen. You're doing a great job documenting everything, right? Even on the times that you said that you placed a call. If you remember the month, you know, just write it down. Keep a log of that, right? And God forbid, if you ever were to get an OSHA citation, never pay it, right? Always get representation, whether you have your own people or you want to use Mondo, because we're able to get those fines reduced, you know, sometimes by 75%. Yeah. So it's you know, they said they were going to hire, I think, God, another 25 to 35% personnel in OSHA. I had personally haven't seen it, thank gosh. And, you know, we're just praying that they don't start walking into, you know, all these job sites and your companies, because they're just going to cause a world of havoc for everybody, even when you're documenting everything that you can.
Yeah. Okay. That's all I got.
Anybody else have any questions?
Hi, can we get a copy of the slides?
Yes.
Yes. He said yes.
Thank you. And thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Nelly.
Yeah, thank you, Nelly.
All right. Well, if nobody else has anything, we are going to end the meeting. Thank you very much, Jeff and Armando. And Armando, I'm sure we're going to be calling you. I text Tom during the meeting. We need to have Armando come in here. And he liked it. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. We are not having a meeting in April. We're going dark. So I will see you all in May. Have a great evening, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.
Take care, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.